This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at UH1.com.
Hi, I'm Anoush, and welcome to the New Statesman podcast. This week I'm joined by Alva Ray and Patrick Maguire to discuss the floods, to give our impressions of the campaign trail, and you ask us, what will Northern Ireland change in this election? Hi, it's Anoush. I'm joined by Patrick and Alva for the Politics podcast this week. We're going to discuss floods, first of all, because more rainfall, as at the time that we're recording, more rainfall is expected in the places that have been ravaged by floods in the past week. There's been a lot of clips of Boris Johnson going up, walking around, trying to sort things out and speak to people, but he hasn't had a very good reception so far, has he?
Gosh, those clips are horrendous, yeah. Aren't they? And very, very sad in a lot of cases. Yeah, so it's day six of the flooding, basically, and you just see all these people sort of asking him where he's been and like sort of, like, there's so much upset and anger. I think the really interesting thing is the way they're also recalling his earlier promises from basically his like pre-election campaign when he was in office after the summer, and making all of these promises in the expectation of an election and targeting exactly those people. And like, they haven't forgotten. They were asking him about his Towns Fund today when he was there, and you know, they're asking him where that is as well. And my feeling is just that, I mean, it's impossible to poll this sort of thing because you're hardly going to poll these people in a really vulnerable, difficult situation. Ask, you know, oh, how are you going to cast your vote on the 12th of December?
What do you think of the backstop?
Yeah, Boris or Corbyn, you know, like, it's impossible to poll this sort of thing, and it would be completely inappropriate to, basically. But I just don't see how this won't undo months of very deliberate targeting of exactly these people, because, I mean, they have an upfront experience of Boris Johnson as Prime Minister, and they feel let down by him.
Yeah, I think the whole episode is an object lesson in the benefits being in government during an election campaign bestows upon you as a campaign, and the benefits of being in opposition. For example, Jeremy Corbyn has been up there, yeah, in his wellies, you know, mixing it with local MPs, most of whom are all Labour, you know, your Flints, your Miliband's, singular Miliband, just Ed.
Although I'm more's sure, the pity.
Yeah, well, exactly.
Listeners, where was David?
Listeners of this particular podcast would love Miliband's in the plural, be that Ralph or David. But anyway, you know, so he can go up, he can crucially just basically say whatever he wants. He could say, you know, a Labour government, not only would this be a national emergency, but I would give each of you money towards a new patio. Whereas with Johnson does have the machinery of the state behind him, so he can say, I'm going to get the business department to give all the shops on the high street that have been flooded special rates relief, or, you know, money for renovations or whatever. But he doesn't have that capacity to be nimble and just pop up and say whatever he likes. He's also constrained by his role in government. Also, they will hold him to account for whatever is happening. You know, he is the Prime Minister, which is why, you know, sort of gives the lies to this whole idea you can run a hopey, changey, turn on the spending taps campaign while you're in government. Because the risk is, hang on, you are the Prime Minister. Why haven't you sorted this out now?
This is why it's so baffling to me that his campaign team didn't think on day one, well, let's get him up there, well, let's seize on the benefits of incumbency, even from a cynical perspective, let's have him there looking prime ministerial, listening, nodding, and sort of sorting it out, and then, like, you know, fudge the details even. But it's like, the way it's day six, and that's such an easy figure for people to be really upset by.
There's a clear parallel here with the London riots, when, you know, he was in an RV somewhere in the Rockies, turned up eventually, then came to Tottenham High Street or wherever it was and waved a broom around theatrically. And obviously when he was in Specsavers, not knowing how to mop, on Friday night. Yeah. There was a clear, you know, it was. I had such bad deja vu, it gave me whiplash. But, I mean, I suppose the crucial thing with the London riots is that he got re-elected the year after. So if I'm going to take that metaphor to its logical conclusion, we're all looking forward to five more years of Tory government.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting what you say about, you know, why didn't they get him up there earlier? I mean, was this sort of situation where he looks like he was late to the scene and uncaring, was it avoidable? Because, I mean, surely they could have known, December election, what are the dangers? One of those dangers is extreme weather conditions, which can, you know, turn people's opinions and can change the focus of what people are talking about. Why didn't they think of that? And it's sort of, it's been a theme, hasn't it, in these areas where there's been flooding, that the funding formula is skewed towards the southeast for flood defences. You know, no one ever comes and cares about us. The leader of Leeds Council, I remember at the time when Tadcaster was cut in half by the bridge being flooded and breaking, I remember her saying, we're ignored. You know, you go and help the people in Somerset who are flooded, but you leave us on our own up here. So, you know, surely it could have been foreseen that there would be that kind of resentment.
And it's not like he's been doing terribly successful campaigning elsewhere. I mean, I know he's been in hospitals, even though that can, you know, turn out to be a bit ropey. But I mean, at one point he was at a crisp factory in Northern Ireland. He was at the Tato Castle, which is your favourite destination for school trips. I mean, what on earth was he doing there? They're not even fielding any candidates, as far as I'm aware. And
yeah, they're fielding four, but like, obviously, as we all know, they're not going to win. No. I mean, he has to sort of, like, as leader of the Conservative Party, like, tip his hat to the existence of, I was told off for saying this on radio also the other day, but like about 50 eccentrics who really care. I suppose, you know, you have to, as much as it's inimical to the Conservative Party, acknowledge the existence of Northern Ireland as an integral part of the UK.
Yeah, and probably get it out of the way at the start of the campaign, basically.
But as you say, like, it's like a waste of half a day when you could be on the stump in Mansfield or somewhere that is statistically significant to this election.
And even with that, you know, that sort of Vogue style 73 questions video that came out last night, that's like really got people's attention. I mean, I watched it right after watching the news. And so, I mean, I don't know if everyone will have this context, but I was just so aware that people will be watching that, really aware of the state of emergency that they're in, or like the really, really sad news stories that they've just seen. And it, like, I think it's still quite bad optics for him to be in his office.
It's quite jarring,
isn't it? Yeah, and for there to be no mention of it. I mean, even if it looked like, you know, he was up at HQ working really hard, but aware of the situation, that would be better.
Yeah, I see what you mean, because it wasn't like there was no policy in that video, was there? I mean, he got to speak about Brexit and all that stuff, as well as Marmite and walking his dog. So it is a bit strange to just leave it out. It was at the top of the news bulletins yesterday.
Because it's interesting, because it sort of exposes the one area on which Corbyn polls well and has a clear lead, which is if you poll personality attributes, as YouGov did last week, the ones where Corbyn has an absolutely stonking lead are on authenticity and does he care? You know, the entire, and this is the big strategic confusion of the Tory campaign, which is, do they paint Corbyn as a crazy Marxist extremist, or just a bit of a sap, a well-meaning sap who, you know, can't tie his own shoelaces? You know, the floods is where, you know, if Corbyn goes up and he hugs a granny whose cat's just drowned and he's there and Johnson isn't, that to me seems an opportunity to turn the I'm authentic and I care into I'm actually, you know, willing to pull my sleeves up and help you out in times of need. Whereas, you know, the inverse is true of Johnson. It's he's a posher who doesn't understand what it means to be an ordinary person, as countless angry people in Doncaster have told him today. Does that then begin to look like incompetence? And it's an interesting question.
And there are a lot of people. I was reading this research that JRF has done into low-income voters whose turnout went up massively last election. There are a lot of people who favour understands people like me over strong leader in terms of the leadership qualities that they prefer. It's, apparently there's over 2 million swing voters who have that preference. So it's quite an interesting contrast.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
So we've all been out and about. Stephen's not with us today because he's in Wakefield. So we're getting around and we want to talk about the impressions that we've been picking up as we've been reporting in different constituencies. So let's talk about where we've been, first of all. Patrick, where have you been?
So I think I've been to, you know, I bet you say that to all the constituencies. But I've been to, I think, three constituencies, two out of which are two of the most interesting in this election, certainly in England, and in their own way sum up the various moving parts in this election. So last week I went to Ashfield and Mansfield in Nottinghamshire. Mansfield, of course, being one of the five Conservative gains the Tories made in England in 2017. Nottinghamshire, Pitt Town, won by the Tories for the first time in their existence. Young Ben Bradley, the MP there, looking to retain it. But next door is Ashfield, which demographically, whatever, ought to have also gone blue. Gloria De Piero, who has since resigned, retained it on a 441 majority for Labour. And now her former office manager, an ex-miner called Lee Anderson, is now trying to win it for the Tories. And on a good day, you would think, well, it's Mansfield 2.0, ex-mining towns and villages. Surely it's inevitable that they win it. But there's a complicating factor in the form of a guy called Jason Zadrozny, who, along with Claire Wright, who Anoush is going to visit next week, is one of the few independent, one of two independent candidates in this election who you would say is the favourite to win their seat. He's the council leader. He's the leader of a party called the Ashfield Independents. Used to run the Lib Dems in the constituency, but was arrested on child sex charges, historical child sex charges, weeks before the 2015 election, where he was attempting to overturn a majority of 192. They were subsequently dropped. He's back. He's leader of the council. And he is pitching himself as the Brexit candidate who can win. And for me, That was a really interesting trip, because you have three candidates who all thought they're in with a reasonable shot of winning, and in their own way are. Obviously, Natalie Fleet, Labour candidate, local woman, works for the National Education Union. Labour vote is still quite sticky. There is an existent Remain vote there of, you know, 30%. If she can keep her vote to something like it was in 2017, she has a decent chance. If the Leave vote is split three ways between Jason Zadrozny for the Ashfield Indies, who is saying, you know, I'm a Leaver, I will vote for the deal, but I will also, you know, stand up for Ashfield as I have done so successfully as the council leader. Lee Anderson, who is attempting to ride the Boris wave into Parliament. And then you've got Martin Daubney, the former editor of Loaded, who is running for whose dad was a Nottinghamshire miner, who is running for the Brexit Party.
They really have it all, don't they?
Wow. I know, so it's a fascinating constituency.
Something for everyone.
And the interesting thing was, you know, I would speak to people there, and the really interesting thing, the person who came up, the J who came up most, God, I'm using all my best lines from my constituency profile, it's not yet published on the podcast, but the J who came up most wasn't Jeremy Corbyn, it was Jason Zadrozny, because everybody knows who he is. He's a phenomenal campaigner, is running the council, and the question most people are thinking is, you know, if I am for Brexit, do I want to vote for an independent MP? And he's running quite a savvy campaign and saying, like, I am a Brexiteer, you know me, I'm a local champion, vote for me. And, you know, he's fishing in the same pool of votes as the Conservatives in the Brexit Party, and, you know, some Labour votes as well, so let's see what happens there. Oh God, that was only one constituency. So the other constituency, let's break it up. But yeah.
Well, for a total contrast, I've been in Hampstead and Kilburn, which, so London, North London constituency, quite affluent. So lots of celebrities living around Hampstead Heath, as well as sort of more middle class West Hampstead and more deprived Kilburn, where Tulip Sadiq is the current Labour MP. And I was talking about this with Stephen and Patrick a few weeks ago, and they were saying that they forget that it isn't technically a marginal at the moment, that her majority, Tulip Sadiq's majority, is huge at the moment, but it has traditionally been a kind of an interesting swing seat that doesn't always move with the national swing. It's been a marginal in the past, and it's likely to be a marginal again, in a way like this is already a marginal, even if it doesn't look like one. So the Conservatives are sort of shortly behind her, and at the moment, you know, in 2017, the Lib Dems got something like 4,000 votes. But they're in with quite a good chance of winning, because it's a sort of affluent Remainer seat. And actually, I think even Tulip Sadiq herself would privately acknowledge that that quite strong majority at the moment is a sort of false majority of, like, resulting from lots of sort of Remainer swings towards her at the last election. So it was really, really interesting being up there, because it's basically, I think it looks like the national fight for the Lib Dems, really, what's playing out in Hampstead and Kilburn. It's really like the fight for the Lib Dems to convince people that they can win there when you look at the figures from 2017 and it looks absolutely hopeless. So Matt Sanders, a former advisor to Nick Clegg and a former local councillor who was hilariously in coalition with the Tories on the council, which the Labour campaigners love to bring up. Matt Sanders is kind of trying to convince people that, you know, they have polling which shows that they're ahead of Labour, that the people who want to remain, who want a sort of, who want to upgrade their Remain vote from Tulip Sadiq, who is herself a Remainer Labour politician, that, like, they can vote for him and they can win. But obviously Tulip Sadiq is kind of already in many ways what those people are looking for, and she just thinks it's, you know, it's ludicrous that he would need to get 30,000 more votes than he did last time to win. But, you know, even like, even affluent Tories in that constituency were saying that they would consider voting Lib Dem to keep Corbyn out. So there's just a, like a, an amazing dynamic there. I think, you know, if the Lib Dems are going to have the surge that they're expecting, then Matt Sanders, you know, may well win there. But it doesn't look that likely when you think about the numbers and who he's up against in Tulip Sadiq.
Stephen has just walked in, fresh from Wakefield, looking buoyant. How was it, Stephen?
Not that buoyant, to be honest. I mean, so I think the thing I found really weird, and I don't know if this is anyone else's going to notice, I think this feels like the least election I have ever covered, right? Mostly, you arrive somewhere, you arrive at the train station, and then because, you know, everyone outside of London is friendly and talks to you, and it's, I'm against it, but it's very helpful from like a journalistic perspective. And they're like, oh, what brings you to Barry Island? What brings you to Wakefield? And you're like, oh, I'm here about the election. And then you get like, it's nice because it means you start with one like vox pop under the, like under your belt. They go like, well, you know, I'm not going to vote for that Ed Miliband. And you're like, oh, interesting. And it's like, and by the way, what is your age, occupation? And yeah, and then you kind of, well, what I always do in every marginal seat is I kind of start with this idea of I'm going to get a bus to the hotel. And then you arrive and it's just like, the next bus is in 2025. Or you could take a cab, which will take you 5 minutes. And then you kind of like swear about how ridiculous it is, how much we neglect public transport outside of London, and get a cab where they go like, what brings you here? And you're like, oh, I'm here about the election. And then they go, oh, well, you know, I used to vote Lib Dem, but now I'm voting UKIP. And you're like, well, the polls seem kind of wrong there. And the same happens when you check in, or when you like sit down to eat like in a Pizza Express alone, and do all of those other kind of like election things, right? I think this is the first election where at every point, whenever people are like, why are you here? And they're like, about the election, they're like, oh, is that show still going on? I've kind of gone off it, to be honest. Like the level of ambient enthusiasm for this electoral event is lower than any I think I have ever covered. Is that just my experience?
Now, my impression coming away from the three places I've been thus far has been turnout is going to be one of the big stories of this election. Not just because we're in winter, just because, as you say, I just think the levels of apathy are quite high. I hate the Brenda from Bristol thing, but there is something in. Not another one. We've done this already. It's also December. You know, a Tory MP said that to me on Saturday. Well, sorry, a Tory candidate who, until the other day, was a Tory MP, you know, was saying people just aren't going to turn out. And interestingly, you know, it's not going to be Fred and Gladys who don't turn out. You know, they'll put an extra vest on and come to the polling station. It will be Worcester woman and Basildon man who, you know, get in from work and say, oh, God, it's raining and it's dark, I don't fancy it. That's the underlay to just a mood of, oh, more of this politics stuff is the, you know, when I was trying to vox pop people in the middle of the day, although to what extent is a town centre in the middle of a weekday representative of anything? But let's not ruin the magic.
Every campaign that I've spoken to so far in the seats that I've gone to visit, I always ask them, what do you think is going to be your biggest challenge to winning or keeping the seat? And they always say, getting people out on the day. And I feel like when I've asked that question in previous elections, sometimes that is the answer, but usually it's, you know, oh, you know, if people care enough about the hospital or whatever, you know, it's an election fought on election terms, whereas this is literally like, can we get people to be bothered to go? And there's very little enthusiasm in the seats that I've been to. So I went to Chingford and Woodford Green, which is Ian Duncan Smith's seat, where his majority was massively slashed last time by the Labour Party, and to Canterbury yesterday, which is Labour's only seat in Kent, where the majority is 187, I think, and the Conservatives are looking to take it back. So I don't know, but I do think this apathy, or maybe not apathy, because people seem to have a very high knowledge of what's going on in politics, but yeah. it's whether or not they want to participate in it because of the way that sort of they've been treated, or they feel that it's playing out. It's been playing out over the last few years. That means that they don't want to sort of lend their support to anyone. I think that sort of spells worse news for Labour than for the Conservatives this time.
Yeah, I think what I thought was fascinating about it, right, is that as well as having deliberately gone to Wakefield and then kind of deliberately tried to swing through the kind of other seats by just kind of going on the Pacer train to other places. The comparison to that, where I was deliberately there trying to get a sense of what people thought, to it was my wedding anniversary last week, and I went to Edinburgh and spent a horrendously large amount of money on books. Two recommendations for people. One, a new bookshop in Portobello called Portobello Books. It is one of the most beautiful bookshops I've ever been to. It's got these very cool sort of modern light. It's very nice. And then the Edinburgh branch of Topping, which is this huge, amazing place with this incredible depth of stock. But the point of that is that more people voluntarily came up to me while I was nominally on holiday, having gone, oh, I listened to your podcast, or oh, I've seen your Newsnight, with a genuine and kind of like, are you here about the election? And kind of, oh, no, you know, what do you think? And they'd be like, I'm really looking forward to voting for, I'm not going to try and name all of the Edinburgh MPs because I'm going to embarrass myself by claiming that Tommy Shepherd, oh, who's an MP in Glasgow, you know,
he is, yeah. Deirdre Brock, Tommy Shepherd, Christine Jardine, Ian Murray, and I think that's
Joanna
it.
Cherry.
And Joanna Cherry, yeah.
Nice. And people were genuinely in every part of the city coming up to me with genuine enthusiasm to vote for the candidates, or to vote for, I'm probably going to get this wrong, Catriona MacDonald, I want to say, is the name of the SNP candidate in Edinburgh South, where Ian Murray is the Labour incumbent. And yeah, the difference between the level of spontaneous enthusiasm I encountered in Scotland and, yeah, the kind of like, oh, you're here about the election. Because the thing I always do to try and counteract the innate unrepresentativeness of a town centre, but is basically I go to the town centre to get quotes, and then I just go and knock on some doors, whether with the local party or sometimes on my own. Mm. And I always think the knocking on the doors, even though you get a very low standard of quote, you get a much better feel, I think, for what has gone on. And yeah, one of the things I kind of wrote offhand maybe last week, maybe beginning of this week, was whoever wins, one of the few things we can be certain about isn't whoever wins will do so with fewer votes than Theresa May got in 2017. I now feel 100% confident in that prediction, and I actually think I feel fairly confident that whoever wins will do so with fewer votes than Jeremy Corbyn got in defeat in 2017. The level of lack of enthusiasm, with obviously the major disclaimer that the interesting thing is basically the thing I keep saying in editorial meetings, the thing I kind of flicked to in the bottom of my column this week, the thing I've blogged on today, which is, look, there's this thing called the TV debates. They're hugely important. They mostly cause non-trivial moves in the polls. I don't know about anyone else, but I now genuinely wonder how many people will bother to watch them simply because of the lack of enthusiasm for politics and this kind of feeling of like, oh, do we have to do it again? And I think that means that, and I'm interested in what others think, but I think that means that the power of the big lie that Boris Johnson is telling, which is that Brexit will be over and we can stop talking about politics afterwards, I think I may have underestimated its pull.
Yeah, it's a very appealing line, isn't it? Because Get Brexit Done can pretty much appeal to any voter. Even if you want to remain and you want to stop the whole thing happening, that's really just to get it over with, isn't it? I mean, you might love the idea that we can remain members of the EU, but Get Brexit Done is vague enough that can kind of appeal to voters in all sorts of places. I think another thing that could change things is the manifestos coming out as well. A lot of Labour activists are relying on the bounce that they got last time round happening again. And now it's time for a section we like to call...
You Ask Us!
Oh, isn't that nice? The whole choir is here. So this is a question that Stephen and I received from Graham Neal over email. What role will Northern Ireland, the ginger stepchild of UK politics, asterisk, I'm from there so I can get away with that, play
you
in
better
this election?
Be.
We actually have a ginger from Northern Ireland in.
Yeah, we do. Yeah. Yeah.
And I would never even say that.
What does it mean?
The ginger stepchild? I don't think that's a phrase.
No, I think it is.
I think it means that it's sort of neglected. The stepchild is neglected.
Isn't the ginger stepchild like something
ginger
about...
Ginger stepchild? Sorry, I thought you were saying like a step made out of ginger.
It's something about...
What? As in, I thought that was some sort of weird idiom, you know, like...
Oh, like a ginger step.
The ginger step child, rather than ginger step child.
Go and sit on the ginger step, child.
I'm sorry.
Is that what your parents used to say to you?
All the time.
Wait, so you thought that he was addressing us as child? He was going, the ginger step, comma, child.
No, I thought he was saying, like... Ginger step child.
Look what you've done, Graham.
The child sitting on the ginger step.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, right.
Okay, so his question
obviously.
His question is, what part will it play in this election? Given British reporting of the country has recently been a bit poor, as Brexit illustrated, poor Patrick there, maligned, is there any indication things are changing?
Depends how you define changing. I mean, there has been a huge change electorally in Northern Ireland ahead of this election, which is the birth of... the electoral pact that really ought to have happened strategically on the Remain side, if you want to call it the Remain side. There's a question of whether that's actually what it is, in terms of other parties standing down for each other in a bid to minimise the DUP's representation at Westminster. So in North Belfast, where Nigel Dodds is defending a majority of 2,000 over Sinn Féin, the SDLP, the moderate constitutional nationalist party, have stood aside, as have the Greens. And in South Belfast, where the DUP pipped the SDLP by just over 2,000 votes in 2017, which Alva is from South Belfast, she can attest that it's, you know, for the large part,
the best
leafy.
Seat in the world.
Yeah, large part leafy, voted overwhelmingly to remain, but is now, you know, paradoxically represented by DUP MP.
I love how leafy is basically politico speak for posh but votes for a left-wing party most of the time.
Leafy.
We all do, literally, it's what it means. Anyway.
Yeah, I mean, not all of it is leafy. You know, there are pockets of deprivation and whatever. But like, you know, when you think South Belfast, you think...
More middle class.
More middle class and slightly more pluralistic in its output. Output, outlook. Although you're pluralistic in your...
In your output.
Your output, South Belfast. And... So, yeah, they're the big two seats where PACs have been agreed. The Ulster Unionists have a new leader in Steve Aitken, who is small L liberal by the standards of that party, a Remainer, former submarine commander. That's not part of his political disposition. It's just fairly interesting. Who made waves on the morning of the DUP's conference by saying, you know what, I'm going to run in every seat in Northern Ireland, including Nigel Dodds' seat, where they haven't run since 2010. You know, and I don't care the consequence for the union, because DUP MPs have shown in their mishandling of the Brexit scenario that they are not the defenders of the union. Then there was a week in which, you know, lots of people within the UUP, within the DUP, some what you might call loyalist paramilitaries, were all saying, Steve, this isn't a good idea. So before Steve Aitken was even confirmed as leader, he just sort of went, yeah, I'm not going to run in North Belfast anymore. And so actually, you know, we've got a really interesting competition in those two seats. Lady Sylvia Herman has stood down in North Down as well. So that's a really fascinating contest. And the question is, there's, you know, one big question is, you know, this is framed as a Remain pact, but it's not lost on anyone that it's mainly nationalist parties standing down for each other.
Yeah.
The others sort of statistically insignificant in most of the seats they're standing down in. And the Alliance Party, a spy opportunity in this, because, you know, they have always rejected electoral pacts, apart from in the immediate aftermath of the Good Friday Agreement, where they stood down for a few pro-agreement people. You know, and they're saying, you know, this is a sectarian cover, we can't allow this. And they hope, actually, in some places, they might be the main beneficiaries of this. Because if you're an SDLP voter in North Belfast, you know, you've stuck with the party through thick and thin, its voters have been squeezed to the extent that they now lose their deposit in North Belfast, or at least they did in 2017. You really, really, really don't want to vote for Sinn Féin for a range of reasons. And, you know, if you are Neil McAllister, the popular former Lord Mayor of Belfast, top of the polls in the council elections in Belfast, you might think, well, actually, those 2,000 SDLP voters are probably more likely to come to me than they are to go to John Finucane, the Sinn Féin candidate. Or they might even go, well, actually, abstentionism is such a deal-breaker for me, or I don't want to vote for Sinn Féin that much. I would rather... OK, this might be a small group, but they might say, well, I'd rather Nigel Dodds my MP than an absentee MP.
In a way, the DUP can never quite match how well they did at the last election, just even in terms of numbers. They did so well. It was a sort of uniquely polarised time in Northern Ireland. They have nowhere else to go except lose seats at this election. And like, and then as Pat was saying, like with Remain pacts on top of that, it looks likely that in somewhere like South Belfast, Emma Little Pengelly, when you look it's gonna be Claire Hann. I think we can call it. That's the only thing I would put money on this election, that it'll be an SDLP MP for South Belfast. That, yeah, the DUP, like, they had nowhere more to go, and I think Remainers in general are more organised this time.
Yeah, I agree with that, but I actually think that even though the DUP ought to only be going down, the call I would make is they'll probably hold North Belfast narrowly for the sort of reasons I set out just then. But also I think the UUP have really missed a trick in North Down, where they haven't run a candidate since Sylvia Herman defected, or rather resigned from the UUP over their ill-fated electoral alliance with the Tories in 2009. And there was a real opportunity there. They ran a big-name Liberal Unionist, like they tried to get George Hamilton, the former Chief Constable of the PSNI, the Police Service of Northern Ireland, to run, or they could have got Mike Nesbitt, their well-regarded former leader, who, slightly before his time, you know, was doing this sort of happy clappy pluralist thing, mellifluous voice, former UTV newsreader, as Alva will be well familiar with. But instead they've run a fairly anonymous local assembly member. Alliance will be fighting with them like a ferret in a sack for that seat. You know, the Lady Herman's vote is going to be cleaved in two. So like, I just sort of think the DUP will hold North Belfast, probably win North Down. They'll lose South Belfast, but then they've still got 10 seats. You might have an SDLP MP or two if Colm Eastwood gets in foil. But, I mean, again, the SDLP have given up on making an intellectual argument against abstentionism. This is the big thing in this election, right? If you say, okay, an abstentionist MP is fine for you in North Belfast, but vote for me, Colm Eastwood, leader of the SDLP, in foil, it doesn't really make sense. And also, like, the sine qua non of the SDLP in these elections has always been, like, we're suitable, we're cuddly, we fought the good fight. Well, we didn't fight a fight.
And please send your complaints to
we didn't fight a fight apart from with hearts and minds and purely constitutional means. Like, we are fine. Like, the DUP immediately after that deal was struck in North Belfast was saying no unionist in foil should vote for Colm Eastwood because, you know, he is on a joint ticket with Sinn Féin, which is, you know, slightly unfair, but that's clearly how it will be, is being sold.
And I think in terms of the question of, is the media coverage going to improve? I mean, I kind of think we've had a pretty good stress test of that, and visibly it won't. I can't remember which vote it was when the DUP took their time getting up, which is not unusual, right, when people vote in the Commons, because it's a very long line, and lots of MPs try and time it quite late so they can spend the bare minimum of time standing in the division lobbies. And people started going, oh, are the DUP abstaining? You know, maybe it could pass. You know, people who literally work for the British Broadcasting Corporation, and one of those things were just like, guys, surely you've got one of these 10 people's mobile numbers. You know, surely, between you, right? You're a huge organisation that we're literally compelled by law to fund if we want to watch live television in this country. And quite visibly they didn't, right? Because then they all started getting, well, then people who did have the numbers of 10 people who passed laws, you know, went, they're not abstaining. They all got up. And I just think one of the really striking things, and in many ways I actually think this is, from the DUP's perspective, the biggest tragedy of their period of political influence, is that it turns out that the rest of Great Britain's level of interest in Northern Ireland is so low that even when the DUP holds the identity of our government in its hands, people still cannot be bothered to treat the 10 MPs from Northern Ireland who actually take their seats as if they are serious political actors, right? There is literally no way that, like, actually, I mean, we've got an exact example of this, right? The 11 Change UK, briefly, MPs, right? There is no way that that many people from the BBC would have been going, oh, well, who knows what these 11 people were doing? I couldn't possibly have the number of any of these 11 people. And I think that, I think, yeah, and even though we may have a parliament exactly like this one, or another one in which those MPs hold the balance of power, I just think that if the last 2 years prove anything, it is that not even that level of influence will improve the coverage of of Northern Ireland by the mainstream press.
I just can't wait for the Sun piece on 13th of December. What is Claire Hannah? How tall is she? who is her husband? Who is her wife?
can you write it so that we steal all the
back? The thing is, I can answer all those questions.
I mean, it's so true. I mean, especially when it was only the DUP, it was one party plus Sylvia Herman to grapple with. I mean, what's going to happen now if another party is added to the mix?
I know, but the thing is, I don't know why I use the honorific.
She is great, though.
In defiance of our house style. Not to blow my own trumpet or blow our own trumpet in how seriously we take this, you know, we're speaking about it on the podcast, but like, I remember on the day of the vote of confidence in May's government, people going, how is Lady Herman going to vote? You know, could she vote this way? Could she vote that way? And like, people were like getting into sort of 20 tweet threads about this. And I was like, well, maybe like one of us could, you know, ring her. So I'm like, I texted her and said, would you vote this? And she just said to me, like, no. It's like, how is nobody, like, we actually work in this building. Like, it wouldn't be hard, like, even if you didn't have a number, just to hang around in Portcullis House and say, hi, Lady Herman, can you answer this question? That's literally what we're there for. It's nuts.
He actually tugged his forelock when he said Lady Herman just then. Yeah. Like,
I'll beseech myself to you. Yeah.
What's she saved in your phone as?
Literally Lady Herman.
And on that bombshell,
as is only right. Yeah.
We'll be back next week. You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Stephen Bush, my colleagues Anoush Shekelian, Alva Ray, and Patrick Maguire. It's recorded by Emily Bootle and produced by Nick Hilton. Our music is still Devil by the Devil, licensed under Creative Commons. If you've enjoyed the New Statesman podcast, please do leave a favourable review on your podcast provider.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.